Steve Bunce.
And I'm Hugh Dennis.
With us are Angela Barnes, Fern Brady, Tom Nelstrop and Graham Fellows. And this is...
The Now Show!
Thank you. Thank you very much. So, President Trump has recognised Jerusalem as capital of Israel, a move seen as controversial and provocative, but which more probably simply reflects Donald Trump's general level of geographical knowledge. He also recognises Istanbul as capital of Turkey, Vienna as capital of Australia, and Sofia as that hot waitress at Mar-a-Lago.
He also famously doesn't read any briefing documents that are longer than a couple of paragraphs. Although David Davis this week went one better than that. He doesn't even have the documents written in the first place, let alone read them. But let's look on the bright side. It's the Middle East and it's nearly Christmas. This could be Trump's version of a nativity play.
And lo, a deeply unwise man came from the West, saying...
Okay, where is he that is called Prime Minister of the Jews? For behold, I bring him glad tidings, the best tidings. Peace on earth and goodwill to all men, except Muslims for national security reasons.
And that night a baby was born in a stable because his mother had no health care insurance as a result of Trump's tax reforms. And gifts were given of gold, frankincense, and myrrh.
Frankincense and myrrh. Very bad presents. Very, 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 very bad. Send them back.
And the animals gathered round, sheep and cows and a donkey.
That is a great piece of ass.
That's enough. That's enough of that. This isn't a pantomime, you know. Anyway, those in favour of Trump's move say that moving the US embassy to Jerusalem will bring legitimacy to a place the world refuses to acknowledge.
The US embassy in Britain is just about to move to South London for much the same reason. The thing is, Trump promised to do it during his campaign, and it shouldn't have come as a surprise, but we keep being caught out by things everyone knew but didn't bother doing anything about.
Yes, for example, we wondered if Brexit hasn't been quite as thought through as we imagined, although the fact that it is less thought through than we imagined is hard to imagine, as we thought it couldn't possibly be less thought through even in our wildest imaginings. But we thought wrong. We assumed that the phrase...
They're making it up as they go along!
...was an amusing exaggeration. But no, in David Davis's case, it turns out they literally are making things up as they go along. In this case, 57 economic impact reports, which he said earlier in the year existed...
in excruciating detail.
And just a month ago claimed needed to be redacted before being released and now says don't exist at all, or they did exist, but he wrote them on his laptop and then lent it to Damian Green and it came back with a virus on it or something. Because apparently everyone shares passwords and the 57 impact reports on Brexit cannot be produced.
Labour have been so much more conscientious. Jeremy Corbyn has produced at least 57 different opinions on Brexit in the last 6 months alone. The basic problem seems to be that our general view of the EU, that is, it's full of dry, boring bureaucrats who are obsessed with detail, is quite correct. And that makes them very hard to negotiate with. What keeps happening is Britain tries a negotiating ploy, then has to back down. And at the moment, as Michel Barnier put it the other day...
The show is now in London.
Yeah, and that show is called The Ploy That Goes Wrong. And as a plus point, having lots of politicians arguing about how to make a country independent means that if they're looking for a musical sequel to Hamilton, then Brexit seems perfect.
When you negotiate, you state you have a preference for equivalence. Don't settle for alignment. This is no time for ambivalence. You state your mandate clearly and don't ever show due deference. This show hasn't opened yet and no one gets this reference.
Wherever you look, there are things that should have been prepared for but weren't. In the US, the Republican Party have had years to plan how to cut taxes, but last week's Trump tax bill was only made available 2 hours before the vote in the middle of the night and was full of crossings out and scribble and handwritten notes, many of which were illegible.
Yes, which is why the list of pizzas and the number for Domino's Washington in the margin of page 12 are now legally tax deductible. It passed in the Senate by a tiny margin of 51 to 49.
Nowhere near the overwhelming mandate they would have achieved if they got, say, 52 to 48. Over here, inequality is similarly not a priority. This week, the government's Social Mobility Committee gave up and resigned en masse, saying nothing was being done as everything was being focused on Brexit. Again, everyone's known the problem for years. Cabinet Office Minister John Trickett said,
"How well people do in life is still based on class, background, rather than on effort or talent."
To which Boris Johnson responded,
"That is utter balderdash and the most frightful piffle-waffle."
But of course, the main engine driving the lack of social mobility is that young people can't afford to buy property. And rather depressingly this week, a 23-year-old with a metal detector found a hoard of gold coins worth £130,000, and when asked what he would do with the money, said,
"It'll probably go on a deposit on an house."
You see, that is really not the glamorous archaeological treasure hunting image that I always imagined from the movies.
So, Dr. Jones, now I have located the Ark of the Covenant, I intend to harness its power.
You don't know what you're dealing with.
Soon I shall possess a 2-bedroom semi in Rickmansworth. Possibly Pina.
He's opening the property supplement.
Shut your eyes. Don't look at the prices. Whatever you do, don't look at the prices.
Ah, my melting face.
He looked at the prices.
And now on the Now Show, a comic known for her appearances on Mock the Week, whatever that is, and as host of Radio 4 Extra's News Jack, is the wonderful Angela Barnes.
Hello, hello. So, this week, North Korea has conducted another ballistic missile test, and Donald Trump has identified Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, which does beg the question, I wonder who the other two horsemen of the apocalypse are going to be. I mean, the world felt safer in hands of pretty much any other US president. Whenever I see Donald Trump on the TV, I get the same thought I have after a particularly painful bikini wax. You know what? Bush wasn't that bad. Of the current situation, China have this week issued information to citizens on the Korean border about what to do in the event of a nuclear attack. This reminded me of being a child in the 1980s when I was convinced that I would die in a nuclear attack. You see, when I was about 7 or 8, I got a book out of the school library that I should never have been allowed to get out. It was by a children's author, Raymond Briggs, you know, who wrote The Snowman and Father Christmas. Some of you are ahead of me. Yes, I'm talking about When the Wind Blows, his satire on the fears of the time. If you haven't read it, it's about an old couple, Jim and Hilda Bloggs, trying to protect themselves in a nuclear attack. And it is harrowing. Spoiler alert, they die. Horribly. Right. It makes the first 10 minutes of Up look like High School Musical. I was traumatised. I remember going home and asking my dad what would happen to us if a nuclear bomb went off. But my dad was an atheist who didn't believe in lying to children, so he just said, "Oh, we'll die." But ever the practical man, to make me feel better, he popped down to the library and he brought home a copy of the government booklet Protect and Survive, which was issued to tell people at the time how they can protect themselves against nuclear attack. You may remember the public information films too.
The government has decided that in the present state of international tension, you should be told how best to protect yourselves from the dangerous effects of nuclear attack.
Comforting, isn't it? They don't have voices like that on the BBC anymore. Oh, who am I kidding? This is Radio 4. The cleaner sounds like that. Sort of starts off comforting, then becomes really chilling, like getting a hug and opening your eyes to find out it's Michael Gove. It told us how to prepare our home and family for attack, so we set to preparing.
You will by now have chosen your fallout room.
Now, this was just before my parents' divorce, so at that stage, every room in our house was a fallout room. It gave you tips on what you should keep stock of.
Drinking water, food, mostly in tins, portable radio and spare batteries, tin opener, bottle opener, some cutlery and crockery. Table and chairs.
Sorry, what was that? Table and chairs? How British is that? We might be under attack, Marjorie, but we're not eating off our laps like savages. I grew up to be obsessed with this period of history, and for my 40th birthday, my boyfriend even arranged a surprise trip to stay overnight in a nuclear bunker. True story, the day of my 40th birthday was the day that Donald Trump was elected. And We were in a bunker. We just looked at each other in a way that said, we live here now. The thing is, I bloody love a bunker. And I also love concrete. I mean, I'm not a communist, but I really like the look. You know? I had a very concrete childhood. You know, I don't mean it was stable. If it had been that, I wouldn't be doing this for a living. No, I mean, there was a lot of concrete around in the 70s and 80s. The flats I lived in, my school, our playgrounds. In the 1970s, children's playgrounds were made of concrete and scaffold poles. Am I right? Yeah. Children's playgrounds in the 1970s were indistinguishable from a building site. The only way you could tell the difference between a building site and a children's playground is that on a building site, they made you wear protective clothes. We were left to fend for ourselves. What, you fell off concrete, you fell onto concrete. You, nobody born after 1987 will have any idea what it's like to have a scab that lasts for 6 years. Anyway, I digress. When I first read about these bunkers, I was living in Crystal Palace in South London, and it turned out there was one at the end of my street. I contacted Lambeth Council to see if it was possible to get in there and have a look, but they told me there's no public access anymore because it has asbestos. Oh, the irony. Yay, we've survived nuclear attack. Oh. Now, I've been visiting decommissioned bunkers for years now, and people used to laugh at my hobby, but they're not so cocky now because during my travels, I have got to meet people. People who have keys to nuclear bunkers. My favourite bunker is in Fife, and it's an amazing place. My favourite thing about it is as you drive along the road towards it, there's a massive sign that simply says, secret nuclear bunker this way. Now, I called Mark McConnell, the manager of Scotland's secret bunker, and I asked him to tell me all about it.
Scotland's secret bunker was built in 1951. It was basically to monitor NATO airspace for nuclear strikes, etc. The basic layout is about the size of two football pitches. It's an office block, really, with no windows. The bunker could actually house up to 300 people at any one time.
See, I reckon I could cope with that. I mean, I've done a whole week at Pontins. And a bunker is now open as a visitor attraction to the public, but during the Cold War, it wasn't for the likes of us, was it, Mark?
No, it wouldn't be for the likes of you, I'm afraid.
All right, mate. And I think what everyone really wants to know is, if it all kicked off now, is the bunker still fit for purpose?
We could certainly close the doors and close the blast doors and hope for the best.
That'd do, wouldn't it? Now, Mark, I know that there's a BBC radio studio in the bunker, isn't there, for broadcasting to survivors, because while they might be crawling through radioactive wreckage, there's no reason to get behind on the archers. And I was thinking maybe I could host a post-apocalyptic radio comedy show, maybe Almost Certainly Dead Ringers, or I'm Sorry I Haven't a House.
No, just head down now.
Well, you heard the man, that's me sorted. Bring it on, world, I'm going to be just fine.
He's had a top 10 single as Jilted John, failed to be selected for Eurovision as John Shuttleworth, but he's here tonight as himself and soon to be on a national tour and his show completely out of character. Would you please welcome Graham Fallows?
Computers seem to think they're very clever, but they're always crashing, so how will they learn to drive? You have made a fatal error, said a PC I thought was clever. It can't have been, for I am still alive. And my laptop is developing dementia. It doesn't recognise my printer like it used to do. When I ask Alexa to play a song, she says, sorry, I don't know that one. Here's a song you might like, I could do, do, do. No, thank you, do, do. I'm getting tired of correcting my spell check whenever I am texting. My wife thinks I'm loving Sue, she's super sexy. When I'm just leaving soon in an Uber taxi. Oh, computers have their own currency now, the Bitcoin. If you haven't hacked one of those, you'll wish you did. Once someone bought a pizza for 5,000 of them, each is now worth 11,900 quid. And still rising. So are computers as stupid as they seem to be? I'd ask Ada Lovelace, but she's dead. The daughter of Lord Byron, who wrote the first computer program, now she walks with beauty on the dark cobweb. Apparently. Siri, what's a Bitcoin? Oh, have you got one of those? Here is a bank account you might like to deposit it in. Mine. Thank you.
Now, please welcome a performer whose latest stand-up show was titled Suffer Fools. So let's hope she's glad to be here. It's Fern Brady.
When I walk on stage, there's two things people notice. Firstly, that I'm a woman, and secondly, that I'm Scottish. I've known I was a woman since I was 15 years old, and my mum finally let me have contact lenses. Because for years before that, I wore these half-inch thick glasses and looked like a teenage Mr. Magoo. I think my mum was doing one of those makeover shows for the world, because once I left the house without my glasses for the first time, that was when men started to generously shout at me in the street about how sexy I was. It was quite a novelty, but 15 years later, it's as boring as a Brexit update. It might just be me that gets catcalled. Maybe I'm the only one that has men wolf whistle at them in the street. Maybe the Scottishness and my slightly robotic gait is irresistible to men. And you know, this week, I don't know if you heard about this, an American company made a realistic sex doll that comes with a sultry Scottish accent. So I've asked my agent to get in touch with the company, because if realism's what they're after, I can give them realism. The doll should come with two settings, yes or no. Nothing to do with consent, but how you voted in the independence referendum. If it was no, then the robot self-destructs. So we're living in a post-Harvey Weinstein era. Have you been following that? I was really pleased, because pre-Harvey Weinstein, I felt like people took reports of catcalling and harassment about as seriously as ghosts or homeopathy. In the audience, do you know what catcalling is of women? Getting wolf whistled, being told to smile or cheer up. And I feel like more people are on board since the whole Me Too hashtag, but there's still some guys on my social media going, well, when is it okay to ask a woman for sex? Well, probably not when I'm eating a Cumberland sausage at a bus stop and you're a stranger and I've just found out my gran's dead. Probably not then, as a rough guideline. And there's still people also saying, well, women are just claiming harassment to get attention, which goes back to the unspoken notion that women are excitable six-year-olds, whereas I think something attention-seeking would be, oh, I don't know, taking your genitals out and showing them to women in hotel rooms. Now, some of the celebrity responses to this, especially female celebrities, have been so dumb. And Joanna Lumley said that women should be flattered that they get things shouted at them in the street. Because in the 60s, women were flattered. But in the 60s, women also had to give up work when they got married. Truly, it was a golden era for women's rights. Now, I think when Joanna Lumley said this, she was picturing a sort of mischievous carry-on film world where builders wolf whistle at you, then cheekily doff their hat. Not like the actual world I live in, where I was on a train and a man decided to rub his willy through his trousers at me for about half an hour while licking his lips. How am I supposed to respond to this? If it was Joanna Lumley, presumably it would be, oh, sir, thank you. Truly, this is the highest compliment to a lady. And it's not just Joanna Lumley giving stupid advice. Angela Lansbury, her out of Murder, She Wrote, and she played a teapot in Beauty and the Beast once. She came out with a zinger last week. She said, attractive women must sometimes take the blame for sexual harassment. They should wear less makeup. Angela, I tried that. I tried not wearing makeup. I put all my hair up into a hat. I stepped outside the house and straight away I got, is that a man or a woman? So you just get a different type of harassment, only now it's, I don't want to have sex with you, instead of, I want to have sex with you. Because it's important we as women get updates all the time. Anne Robinson said women should laugh in the face of sexual harassment. And I tried that with a guy on the train. It just made him go faster. Can I just ask, have any women in the audience been catcalled? Some of you, the rest of the Radio 4 audience. No, we're middle-aged, and as middle-aged women, it gives us the power of invisibility. Now, if you shout back at your catcallers, they'll usually shout one or two things at you. Does anyone know what they'll shout?
Are you gay?
Yes, correct. They'll either shout, are you gay, or they'll call you a slag. Now, if they call you, because they'll never call you a bitch, because that would be admitting that you've hurt their feelings, right? But if they call you a slag, presumably the intent is for you to go, oh, sir, this truly is a stain on my reputation. Please do not tell the other villagers. Or they say that you're gay, or they call you a lesbian, because, of course, that could be the only possible reason a woman wouldn't want to be seen as a bipedal willy warmer for men. Do you know, most people know Christmas is coming because of a heartwarming ad campaign on the telly, or their favourite sandwich shop starts doing the Christmas edition of a sandwich. I knew it was Christmas in my area because a guy shouted, nice arse, and then paused and went, Merry Christmas. You've been so lovely. I've been very ready. Good night.
Right, so the NHS started trialling a new app this week called GP at Hand, which allows patients to leave conventional surgeries and see a doctor via video link on their phones 24/7. But here at The Now Show, we thought, why bother with one-to-one consultation when you can do one to several million?
So, we have invited an actual doctor onto the show to help answer your questions and indeed ours. So, please welcome doctor, rugby player, stand-up comedian and your mother's idea of the perfect son-in-law, Kwame Asante. Hi there.
Hi, Kwame, how are you doing?
I'm very well, thanks.
That's
are you?
Very good. That's the kind of question the doctor should be asking his patient, clearly. Anyway, so you're a practicing A&E doctor. What do you think of GP at Hand?
Well, I think GP at Hand is essentially a platform to sort of build on the already established telephone consultation model. But I think it's interesting because the government's obviously rolled this out in an attempt to increase efficiency. But at the same time, there are already so many apps out there, and I think it would be more efficient to just let doctors give advice over some of the apps that most people already have, like Instagram. I can imagine just someone like, oh, doctor, I've got a rash all over my face. And I'm like, yes, okay. All you need to do, black and white filter, increase the brightness, decrease the contrast, beautiful, you're good to go. Thank you. That's all we have to do.
Can we ask you about, there have been lots of health stories in the papers this week.
Yes.
Eating a matchbox-sized piece of cheese, right, every day, reduces your risk of heart disease by 14%. Do you think that's true?
So I actually read a bit of this paper, and I think some of the researchers found this sort of relationship and thought it may be linked to some chemicals within cheese that reduces arteries clogging up with fat. I always worry about like how people at home might interpret this kind of information, because some people might think, oh, if a matchbox-sized bit of cheese reduces my risk of heart attacks by 14%, maybe a kilo reduces my risk by 100%. Maybe 2 kilos and I'll grow a whole new cheese heart and it'll be stronger than the original. I don't know. So,
Do you think that, you see, I could easily down a pint of Branston pickle.
Right.
Will that bring any additional benefit, you think?
Well, I think if you were to down a pint of Branston pickle, it probably would lead to social isolation, which we already know is linked to poorer health outcomes, which is why friends don't let friends binge drink pickle. Thank you.
Okay, now this was a report by the European Society of Cardiologists that claims that premature hair loss and greying is a risk factor for heart disease.
Well, I think it's a bit of a chicken and the egg sort of phenomenon, because you're not sure whether baldness causes strain in the heart, whether it's that causes the baldness. Yeah, so actually I found this study really interesting because the researchers were like, oh, but you know, there's nothing that a balding person can do to change any of this. And I was like, well, then why publish that information? As if like going bald, losing your hair wasn't already stressful enough and you just tagged on heart disease onto it as well.
But do you think, I mean, given if there is a link, do you think you could reduce your risk by just wearing a nice bubble hat?
A bubble hat to reduce the risk of...
Well, I think part of the risk is looking in the mirror and going, oh, God.
I think I'm more surprised at how much a bubble hat increases your self-confidence here.
As we mentioned earlier, we did ask our audience if they would like to submit their medical questions for
you. I've been looking
forward
to this
willing
a lot.
to go for a few of these?
Yeah. The first question I have for you is, how many units per week do you drink?
I drink no more than 3 to 4 units a day, never exceeding 28 units a week, with at least 1 or 2 alcohol-free days a week.
That's exactly what I always tell my doctor. Yes,
exactly. How many jars of Branston do you think I'm on?
Well, I think the old saying as an alcoholic is someone that drinks more than their doctor. So I think from the pickle point of view, I think that's still too much pickle.
Okay. This person submitted several questions, and one of them is, was Doctor Who actually medically qualified?
Here's one. Why do French doctors administer drugs through a different orifice?
I don't know. Maybe it's patient choice?
What are the key words I need to use to get an appointment?
This is a medical legal nightmare. The key words to get an appointment, I think you just have to be, especially
ill?
Well, I mean, just be honest and...
If the muscle spasms get worse when I laugh, why did I come to the Now show?
Because you're a glutton for punishment with great taste in radio.
Well, I hope that has satisfactorily dealt with your questions. Thank you very much, Kwani Asante, and thank you for listening, and goodbye.
You've been listening to The Now Show, starring Steve Punt, Hugh Dennis, Angela Barnes, Fern Brady, Graham Fellows, Tom Nelthrop and Kwame Asante. It was written by the cast with additional material from Jenny LaVille, John Hunter, Laura Major, Mike Shepherd and Sarah Gibbs. The producer was Victoria Lloyd. It was a BBC Studios production.